We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that we will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight we have Sam from Oakwood. I've seen her probably more often in the Serenity House at Buford at the noontime meeting over the last couple of years. I'd taken a job there, and I was about 9 months sober. Sam has a way of making sense out of chaos. I just want to thank you personally, Sam. You meant the world to me and my sobriety, and I've just wanted to share you with the folks here at NABA. And it's my pleasure to introduce you, Sam Chester.
Hello, everybody. My name is Sam, and I am an alcoholic. And I, like Mikey, do not like a microphone. I had one wired up to me one time, and that thing went off. And it started at my big toe and came straight up my right leg. And I got very nervous. And since then, I've been extremely nervous. Slide her back out of the way. Can you hear me now? How about the back row? I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to tell my story in a general way under instructions from my higher power. My second in charge higher power. That's my significant other. I'm instructed not to talk about bedwetting, sex, some of my drunk escapades, to keep it on a general level, not a specific level, and I'll attempt to do that. If I slip, like most alcoholics do occasionally, in their mind, in their heart, I've got witnesses to the fact that we'll probably tell them. So anyhow, I'm going to try to keep it just as clean as I can keep it. I want to thank Jim and Mikey and Ken, Jill and Tim and some of the other, Keith. I've sat in a lot of meetings with these people, and some of the others I may recognize later. But they've meant a lot to me personally during my sobriety, and especially in the last 6 months. I want to share the past 6 months with you before I start my story, because it left a stamp, a lasting impression on my brain, okay? My significant other, Carol, was hit by an automobile. February 19th of this year. On Green Street, walking across the street in front of the post office on Green Street. And she took a lick to the leg and broke her leg and crashed it. She went on the car, back on her head. Multiple fractures on top of her head, separated all the bones. Massive brain trauma. The whole nine yards. Future drills through the head to drain. And then I started to learn about recovery. Personal care. Given. That I had received all these years from hospitals and nurses and doctors, but I had absolutely no idea how to get it. So, the first, you can imagine, the first month of bringing her home, like a small child just born, the baths, the food, into the bed, out of the bed, into the wheelchair, back again. There's a very definite learning curve. I would have been far better off if I'd gotten involved with this years ago. And as a father, I did some of it. I changed a few diapers. You know, I wiped away a few tears. But when it comes to personal giving, there's nothing in this world that I think, under God's creation, is more important than someone that will give care to the sick and suffering. And in this program, I've found more people that do that than anywhere else in my professional life. So as you go through your days of getting sober and being sober, Introduce yourself to these people that are out there on the firing line. The nurses, the doctors, the folks that give rides to the veterans, the people that go to the homes of the suffering, take care of the young people that are wayward, that counsel with their other family members. But get in touch with these people so that our level of service in AA will be elevated to a point of acceptability. Is a good word, I think. Sometimes I think we fall short. We come, we partake, we leave, and don't get involved. The good news is Carol drove yesterday for the first time. She drove today for the first time by herself. She's over at her daughter's house in Gwinnett County. And she'll drive home where she's already home before dark. But I can tell you that it just changed my life completely. I got a deeper feeling for humanity. God's creation. And the miracle of God and what He can do for the suffering. The recovery. It should have never been recovered. If it hadn't been for friends coming in and building ramps for the wheelchairs and moving furniture so that the wheelchair could operate in the house and tearing this out and adding that and bringing food. My God, we didn't buy any food for the first 2 months. AA members just showed up everywhere. So I'm just telling you, if you want a fellowship where you would never, ever, ever be alone again, this is the place. And this is the time. And jump in with both feet. Okay, now let's start a little AA program. I'm going to keep it very brief. Born in 1938 to a couple of sharecropper parents. I was the fifth child, the second boy, in Barrow County near Winder, Georgia. And we lived there until I was 4 years old. As some of the old timers remember, the war was starting to crank up, and we all packed up five kids. By then we had six. My sister was born right behind me down in Winder. We moved to Atlanta on State Avenue, and I was talking to Tony earlier. He knows exactly where I used to live down there. 646 State Avenue. Across the street from the cattle warehouse. A mill house. Bathrooms outside. You know, no underpinning. The wind came under the house and kept you pretty cold. In the wintertime, it cooled you in the summer. But it was there that my mother and daddy, God-fearing people, went to church. He led singing in the Baptist church for 46 years. He taught me right from wrong early. He taught me how to tell the truth. He taught me to treat people fairly. My mother taught me how to be gentle and kind. To be giving and share whatever I had with other people. These lessons I learned pretty well early on in life. Later in life, I forgot a lot of these lessons because alcohol drove my feelings inward. And about the only thing I did was bask in my glory. In other words, I was so eat up with self that all I could talk about was how bad I felt, how pitiful I was. And I'll get into some of that later. But anyway, we were there. The war started. Pop was working across the street building boxes to put the war material in. Mother was over there packing the boxes with, you know, material to go overseas to the fighting boys. Her brother, I wasn't very old. I was only six or seven at the time. But my favorite uncle before he took off to the war, Horace, was killed in that war. I never will forget him coming back in the box and being buried there in Barry County. But anyway, that was a real tragic time. Mother suffered through all that. There were four more kids born at home in that house, which made 10 kids. Five boys, five girls. All by the same parents. Pretty unusual, you know, in today's reality. But close-knit. Learned to love. Didn't know we was poor. wore hand-me-downs. We wore shoes as a kid that had, you had to put the cardboard in them, you know, to make sure you had enough footing underneath, you know, to go to school. We took our lunch to school. Kind of embarrassing. A lot of the kids, you know, get the money, get the soup, get the sandwich. I'd take my sandwich, I'd trade it for a bowl of soup. I was a pretty good salesman early on. I could sell a pineapple sandwich with gooey for a really good bowl of soup. I could just tell them how good that pineapple was. And their mouth would go to water. Next thing you know, I was eating soup. They was eating that old soggy pineapple. But that was a lot of fun. I went to Least Street Grammar School. A couple of highlights. Pretty decent student. But we hung around the school after school. Y'all always had a groundskeeper. The lady stayed there. And we'd leave out and get home before dark. But anyhow, I learned to fight there. I learned to protect myself by getting hell kicked out of me a few times. and pardon my expression, sometimes I get carried away. I know it's on the board, no cussing, okay? If I get out of hand, somebody just raise your hand and say, stop that. But we learned to fight on that playground. And, you know, you had to go before the board, the principal, and they set you out in the hall, and then everybody comes by and they put their hand on your head, poor little Sammy. Poor Sammy, just embarrassed the heck out of it for 2 weeks. Went through that. One day in the sixth grade, they come ask me if I wanted to be a patrol guy, and I said, yeah, I'll be a patrol guy. So they gave me this white belt, had a badge on it, put it on, you went down to the intersection, and you walked the other students across the street. Next year, I became the captain of the patrol. Now I could ride a bicycle. The only problem is, I didn't have a bicycle. So I conned one of my buddies into the best position near the school, where it's just a half a block away from the school, if I could ride his bike. So I put him at that slot, and I rode his bike to do my check on the other guy. We all took off to Washington, D.C. in the old Nancy Hanks train. If you want to look it up on the internet, just look up Nancy Hanks train. Traveled out of Atlanta up to Washington, D.C. and on up into New York City. But we rode that train, and we beat each other with pillows until we had nothing but feathers in the car. And then here come the teachers. And here come the punishment. And we had to pick up every feather in that car and get rid of them. But that's the type of experience that I recall that's unforgettable. There was a lot of others. We used to shoot a lot of marbles out in the yard, and we'd use marbles for money. We'd trade that for food. You know, for a bowl of soup, we'd get a couple of toys and, you know, four or five marbles and shoot. Everybody know what a toy is? Yeah, y'all don't know nothing. Toys are what you shoot marbles with. And the best toy you could get was a steely. That was a metal ball bearing is what it was. And the ruler's press was right up the street from where I lived. So we'd stop by a ruler's press and go to the window, and they'd reach out and hand us the steelers right out the window. And those steelers meant money to me because I could shoot the devil out of a steeler. I could knock more marbles out of a circle than with that and anything else. We learned how to shoot. We learned how to hunt. We learned how to fish. We learned how to shoot flips. You don't know what a flip is. Slingshot, okay? Come on. A flip is one you make. A slingshot is one you buy. That's the difference. And the best thing you could make out of was an old rubber tire that they made during the war. But see, after the war, you couldn't hardly find that red rubber. So you hoarded that stuff and you hid it. I had red rubber 15 years after the war. But anyhow, time to go to high school. Good summer, time to go back to work. During that time, that summer, I worked on a fruit truck, you know, selling peaches. I remember, hey, peaches, peach boy. Take up a little bucket like that and go from business to business and sell a bucket of peaches for a quarter. Did pretty good that summer, made some money. But anyway, I had to go start to high school, and holy moly. That's where I was introduced to the Sylvan Hill 16 bus. Y'all know what the Sylvan Hill 16 is? Look it up on the internet. Sylvan Hill 16, number 16. It was a bus that went by the house on Stewart. By then, we'd already built another house right off Stewart. But see, when I moved to Stewart Avenue, they had electric cars with electric. You remember the electric cars like they got now down in New Orleans that have the electric power overhead? Well, see, during the icy storms and all those things would jump the track and they couldn't go nowhere. They'd have to sit there. So I made a little money, you know, selling a little coffee to the folks on those cars occasionally. Not a lot, but every now and then we'd do anything for a nickel. But on that street, there's a lot of fun took place. We'd take a big old pocketbook, tie a rope to it, climb up in a china bear tree, leave the pocketbook out in the street, and here come these old cars. Whoop! They'd jump out and reach for the pocketbook, and we'd yank the cord. They'd chase that pocketbook across the way. We'd pull as fast as could hit. One of them grab that thing, cut it with a knife. Kept by a pocketbook. Made us mad. Next time we throw china bears at them. But just fun stuff. I mean, kids, innocent days, innocent time. High school. Sims Hill 16. Go to high school with my two sisters. They put me on the bus. My first experience riding the bus on a regular basis. And quite honestly, it was not that good for me that first few weeks. See, all the students I went with to school with, at Lee Street Grammar, went to Brown High School. They had built this new school called Sylvan Hills. We lived across the tracks on Stewart Avenue. The dividing line was apparently, I guess they call that Lee Street up there. That was the dividing line. So I went, and I sat in classes with folks like kind of like now. I didn't know anybody. I felt alone. I mean, it was a come down for me. I'd been the captain of the patrol, you know, in the seventh grade, you know, and here I am, nobody knew mine, didn't know how great I was, you know. So I kind of withdrew and got inside myself, started biting my fingernails. You know how people do. Weathered that storm and went on through shooting basketball. Learned how to shoot basketball pretty good. Using an old rim out in the yard on a dirt track, just shooting till dark. A lot of times after dark, if the moon came out. And my coach, Ozzie Waterwitch, saw me one day out on the road, out on the Sylvan Hills yard, and said, "I want you to play some basketball." I said, "I don't know about that." He said, "Why?" I said, "I'm to work." He said, "You what?" I said, "I work." He said, "Well, how would I go about getting you on my team?" I said, "Well, you'd have to ask my daddy." So he got the number, and the next day he was over at my house, and he talked to my daddy, and my daddy let me play ball. So in the 10th grade, 9th grade, I joined the team, and his brother, Richard, coached me in the 9th grade. And of course, we scrimmaged against the varsity in the whole 9 yards. And before you know it, I'm going in 10th grade, make the team, start in the 10th grade, having a great time. So now I'm starting to work back into the group. But about this time, I met that good-looking, blue-eyed beauty at church. Back then, what happened, I went down to Florida and worked during my junior year, between junior and senior year. And I came back from Florida all tan and gorgeous and beautiful and hard as steels. I mean, I was hauling that. We were building elevators, believe it or not. And we hustled that big old rail up and down those shafts and motors. And we did it with chain falls. You pull the chain and jack this stuff up. And I was a pretty healthy boy when I came back. But I walk into church and I look up in the choir and I see this girl and boy, she got some blue eyes and knock you out. And I kind of wondered what she had. And I was about ready to go in there to get it. You know what I'm saying? And she looked at me and she had the same feeling. So all of a sudden we hook up in the next 2 or 3 days and before she finished high school, she was only in the 8th grade. I finished high school 2 years later, and she finished high school going to school after we married. Catching the bus, going downtown to Smith Hughes High. That was a transitional school for folks that you couldn't go to the regular school because you were married. So that's how that came about. And my first son, Greg, was born to... Anyway, we married on her 16th birthday, believe it or not. I was 18 years old. She was 16. We married. We went up to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and stayed at the White Horse Hotel up there. Consummated that marriage, and I didn't know what I got into. Her daddy was mean as hell. He was one of us. He was a drunk. I mean, he was a real drunk. But anyhow, I got past all the mouthing and all that. He didn't even come to the wedding. I got past all that, and we finally started to develop a relationship. Greg was born, and he'd look at him and say, "You Sammy Chester looking little rascal, you." That's me. Talk to my son. And he died knowing that I took good care of his daughter, though. Because from the time we married, I did route work with Marita Bread and Georgia, Miss Georgia Davis. And by the time I was 22, I bought my first home, a three-story brick home down off Brown's Bridge Road in South Atlanta. And from there, we had two more children at home, and then we ended up going to Chattanooga, Tennessee. I got out of route sales and went into... Now, all that took place, and the only real drunk that I can recall happening, we made a trip when I was a senior down to Savannah, and we played Savannah High School and Benedict. The first night we played Benedict High, we won a game that we wasn't supposed to win. We all ended up on the beach in February. We built a bonfire. And it was cold. I mean, it was really cold. And all of a sudden, you know, you got naked people going in and out of the ocean. And they come back yelling and screaming, "Oh, I'm freezing," and they're wrapping around the fire. And then some of the boys that drove down their own cars down, you know, to cheer for us, they come out with the booze and the liquor. I take a few sips and like what I'm, next thing you know, I'm in the ocean. But now, this, you know. I come back and I wrap myself around the fire and I'm about to freeze to death. And all of a sudden, the boy gave me something. I don't know what it was, but it had to be some of the best liquor you ever ate. Because it knocked me out. And that's all I remember. Till I woke up in my room at the hotel and that bed was spinning. And I can really remember trying to put a foot on the floor trying to stop that bed. And then my lights went out again, and that's all kind of all I remember. But the evidence was there the next morning of a drunk and what drunks do when they really get drunk and sick. That was the only drunk that I can recall in during my high school years. Okay. Later on, I got into chemical business, and you know, if you're a salesman, a very successful salesman, there's a couple of things you need to really get a grip on, and that's entertainment. You have to learn how to drink like a man, you know what I mean? And you got to feed these customers booze on the golf course, on, you know, at the deer camp. You take them fishing, you got to have the, you know, the Budweiser and the J.W. Dent or whatever they drink. But you can't, you have to drive home most of the time. But I didn't learn my lesson too good. I became the customer. They had to take me home. So anyhow, after some foolishness and silly escapades with customers and getting really messed up, I found it necessary to not drink. By now, see, I'm coaching kids. I'm teaching Sunday school classes. I'm working with customers. I'm entertaining customers. I'm having customers in my home. We're cooking out. It's just a joyful life, except when I got drunk. And it only happened occasionally. I guess some folks would call that a periodic. I have no idea what that is, but I can tell you this. I could not tell you when I would cross the line. I would just cross the line. Nothing told me when to quit drinking. See, a healthy person has a brain that tells them, look, you've had two drinks and you're fixing to get in that car and drive it. Okay, so stop drinking. I didn't have that defense. I didn't have the defense against the first drink. Because my mind wasn't normal. There was something genetically wrong with my brain that allowed booze to hit me and me to keep drinking, knowing it was going to hurt me or somebody else. So, during that time, those periods of drunkenness became closer, every 6 months maybe, 3 months, 4 months, 2 months. And over a period of like 15 years, I became a daily drunk. So what happened, by the time I was 40 years old, I entered this program February the 21st, 1978. I had been spending the past 3 years mostly in a drunken state. Now, you've heard of double lives, and you've seen folks that you probably can accuse people of having a double life. I would take a bath or shower in the morning. I would get up and I'd put on a pinstripe suit, you know, white or yellow shirt, and I'd put on that blue tie or yellow tie. And I'd take a wig, you know, and I'd put tape here and I'd put tape here and I'd put my wig on and I'd fluff it, you know. And spray it so it'd stay in place. Kids is out of school. Mama's gone to school, gone to Old Mercy University work. What am I going to do? I'm going to go sell my $1 million worth of stuff today, right? I'm going to make up with all that. I'm behind now 3 months selling. I got to catch up, right? I'm just going to go catch up today. A legend in my own time. That's my thinking. And on the way, something happens. Get a little nervous. Can't stop them shakes. My throat gets dry. I start shaking all over. I'm driving the car and I'm shaking. Where do you go? You put it in a liquor store. You get that JW. 100 proof. 6-pack of beer. Get back in your car and you start wandering. I became a wandering generality. I wandered into the liquor store and got my booze. I wandered back in the car and I wandered down the road. I went into, you know, a damp, dark, dirty bar and sat there and drank two or three more beers and hit the road. When I thought about it, I looked in the mirror and looked at my face and my dang wig had turned sideways from sweating. I didn't have sense enough to know I looked like hell. That's a pitiful state. Many times I pulled it off in disgust and pulled the tape and wrapped it up and stuck it in my pocket and went on with my drinking. Drive out to Tobosoft Park, pull in, love to fish there. Oh, I dreamed of fishing there so many times. Imaginings. People call it imaginings, you know. I have to imagine having that rod and reel and I'm catching fish and I'm catching these big bass and I see these cars going down the highway. I wonder where them fools are going. Lunatic. A mind is messed up. Out of balance. Out of touch with reality. Where does help come from? One of my later drunks, my son that's a paramedic today that picks drunks up off the road, that's a sergeant on the fire patrol over in Cherokee County, came in one night, blasted. And I went to the door and I said, what are you doing?
Nothing.
Where you been?
Hell.
Had a mess on him. I said, you go to bed, we'll talk in the morning. Next morning, I get him up early. I made a pot of coffee. I reprimand him for drinking and driving. He said, Daddy, you drink and drive. I said, excuse me? He said, you drink and drive. I said, yeah, but that's my damn car. And I paid insurance on it. What are you talking about? He said, but you're still driving, right? Let me tell you something. That happened sometime in the fall of 77. And it gnawed in this gut and in this heart and mind for every day. And that's all I could think about for just days and days and days. I just couldn't put it together. Then we took a trip out to Warner Robins to a New Year's Eve party on the 30 days has September, April, June, and November. Has 31 days, right? So we go out to a New Year's Eve party. I do pretty good. I got my wig on. I look good. I mean, I got on a good-looking outfit. We stop in the rain, and I go to the trunk of the car, and I was driving an LTD station wagon. I used to call it LSD. For a lot of reasons. But anyhow, it was an LSD station wagon. Had the boards on the side. You remember? You would look. Go back there and open that trunk on the back. You got all those seats, and, you know, if you get down low enough, can't nobody see you sitting in. Mama couldn't see me back there, right? Took a swig at J.W. Dent to buffer up that liquor I had drank at home before we came to leave. But I had heard early in my drunkenness that if you drank olive oil by volume, a good bit of it, drank it and put it in your stomach, that liquor won't penetrate. It won't go into your bloodstream. That's a lie. And I tell you why. I got that party, and I went in, and I shook hands, and I met a couple of innocent people and a couple of potential customers, big buyers. And I had another drink in, another drink there, and a pat on the back, and a pat of folks on the back, and glad hand my folks, and before you know it, my lights go out. Next thing I know, I hear a voice that sounded like a train way off. This door opens, and the boy says, where is he? I don't know. He came out this way. We got to find him. He'll freeze to death out here. There he is. Let him lay there and freeze to death. Blam! The door slams. I'm laying there thinking, that's a hell of a way to treat a good person. I'm laying there, and I feel this stuff in my face. It felt really funny-like. Then I realized for what it was sleep. Sleeping. You know what I'm thinking? Oh, good old Al-Anon thoughts. Sam, you got to get up from here and get your butt in that house and get straightened up before Carolyn embarrasses you in front of all those people. Now think through that a minute. Think through that a minute. Is that an alcoholic or not? Is that passing the buck? I mean, did we ever not pass the buck, you know, as drunks? We could always find somebody else to blame it on. So anyway, I did somehow know I found the energy, the strength. I got up, I went in, I brushed off, I readjusted that wig, I dried off. They say I danced. I fooled around with the games. And I just had a blast. I had a really good time. I slept on the sofa a while, and I drove home in the blackout. In the rain. And asleep. Don't remember. I don't remember a thing after I went back in that house. So anyhow, Carolyn, she wouldn't want to speak to me. You know how you get the silent treatment? Did you ever give the silent treatment around the house? Get mad at somebody just don't even speak to them. Speaking of them. She had her jaws poked out to here for weeks. And I decided on the 21st, not weeks, 3 weeks actually. I decided on February the 21st, that's enough craziness. If there's a way, I'm going to do this thing. So, during all that time, I'm running from my boss. I make my first meeting on the 21st. The next morning, I'm at home, and the gym keep up with the time. What time is it? Thank you. I go to my first meeting with my wig now, with my good-looking coat and yellow tie. I'm proper. I drive around the building. I got the address from the Yellow Pages. Thank God for Yellow Pages. Drove around. I see the church, Presbyterian Church on College Street in Macon, Georgia. I said, ain't nobody up there. I look in, but I see this light in the front of the building. There ain't no cars. So anyhow, I circle one more time and park a block down the street in a vacant parking lot that was a service station, and I walk up the street. Shaking. Legs trembling like weak spaghetti. I'm thinking, I'm getting these flashes. I mean, what is this all about? What are you doing? All I know is I cried out that morning for God, help me. Just help me. I walked up those steps and I got high enough to look through the windows where the light was coming from, and I saw a guy with a white collar sitting behind a desk. And he looked and saw me, and I looked and saw him, and he walked around to the door. He opened that door and he looked at me, and before I opened my mouth, he said, "You must be looking for AA." I said, "Yes, sir, I am." Now, how would he know that? You know, wig laying sideways. That'd be a pretty damn clue. That'd be a good clue, wouldn't it? Trembling like, you know, voice up and down, just scared to death. Absolutely scared to death. He said, "Come go with me. I'm John and I'm an alcoholic." Pastor John, he called himself. "I'm an alcoholic." He said, "Come go with me. I'll show you where to go." We walked down. It looked to me like, you know, the walk of death a mile away. It couldn't have been no further than hitting that wall right there. But we made it to that point. We started down those wooden steps. And into that, and I counted those steps later in life, and there were 12 of them, which I thought was synonymous with what I was, God was trying to do with me. But anyway, I walked. He opened the door. Guy with the finest looking, looked like my wife's eyes, blue eyes, sharp as a tack, white hair. Some of you guys will know him. If I called his name, is Roland Chester. John said, "Roland, this is Sam." He said he'd like a meeting. Roland said, "My name is Roland C., and I am an alcoholic." Roland's passed away now. But when he said, he told me his last name was Chester. And I said, "Well, you know what? That's my last name, Sam Chester." He said, "Oh, really?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, welcome. Let me get you a cup of coffee." And he could tell by the way, you know, I was acting. He didn't give me a full cup. He gave me a little less than half a cup of coffee. And I took that cup and I went over there and sat down. And two or three other people came over and welcomed me, like Tony welcomed me tonight. And Tim. And we had a meeting. And I picked up a chip. And I made a meeting there on Tuesday and Thursday night until I left Macon, Georgia, 6 or 7 years later. In addition to that, I made meetings all over town, all over middle Georgia. Roland would take me here and there. Some of you guys might know a guy here by the name of Matt H. Matt Henry passed away 3 years ago. You know Matt? That was my sponsor. Second sponsor. I had two sponsors, Roland and 29 years met with my sponsor. Everywhere I went, I'd call him, he'd call me. But the thing about it, I felt when I picked up that chip like a weight was lifted off me. I don't know if y'all felt that or not, but it was like, man, what took you so long to get here, you know? People talked to you after the meeting. We went outside under the big old tree, you know, and we talked. It'd rain, we'd go back inside the building, dry our feet off, go back under the big old tree and sit out there a while. But they talk to you, then they take you home with them, and you drink their coffee. And that little Ruth Chester, she taught me more about Alcoholics Anonymous than anybody else. She was a black belt Al-Anon. A pit bulldog that never lost. And she jacked me one night and she said, you know, you're mistreating your wife and those children. You need to go to work and take care of them. And Ruth, I'm trying to find, you ain't trying to find a job. You screw it off, all. Your problem is you're self-centered. You're an egomaniac. You need to get your stuff together. All this didn't happen one time. I mean, this is over a period of months, okay? Every time I go to rolling, I'd go over there to get the step work done, and I'd get this tongue lashing. See, that she wouldn't back off. See, I made a mistake and I took Carolyn to the first Al-Anon meeting. After I went on Tuesday night, I took Carolyn Thursday night. And boy, her and Ruth hit it off like that, and she fought for Carolyn. She told me, you go to work. So finally, her husband, Roland, I've been hanging out at the clubhouses, helping build clubhouses, painting, washing, using 401k money to and insurance money and everything else I had in savings to pay my bills, and I owed everybody in town, and it was getting desperate. I got sicker in this program than I was before I came in the program. I was on the dead run from reality. I didn't have no reality at all the first 6 months in this program. I was crazy as a lunatic. Bedbug crazy. But thank God there were people around me who had the good sense to tell me, you need to go do so and so. So Roland says one night, you've really got to get a job. I said, well, put out resumes. Did this. That's fine. I said, we got your job. I said, do you have? He said, yeah, we want you to report the bill late in the morning. I said, what is that? He said, that's a beer distributorship. Unloading trucks. Sweeping the warehouse and cleaning up the glass, broken glass. How much you pay? It don't matter what he pays. Just I want you there working. I reported the bill late. And I learned to work again. The second day, he put me out in that yard. By now, see, it's like June or July. And he put me out there, putting up railroad ties in the yard. Building a wall by myself. Heavy stuff. Cut them and hang them, nail them, and big old nails with a sledgehammer. That really did help to clear a lot of the cobwebs out of my system, out of my brain, and it gave me self-worth when I got that paycheck. I mean, it wouldn't go around, but my sponsor taught me it don't have to go around. It just has to go a little bit to each one. You don't pay nobody all of it. And then you write a note and you tell them what's going on in your life and when you expect to be able to pay them on a regular basis. And there was only two companies, and I won't disclose who they were, that didn't work with me. I'll say this, I hadn't bought anything from them since. Now, is that a grievance? Was that a resentment? Well, what is it? I think it's fair. If they don't treat folks fair, I think it's okay. But anyhow, to make a long story short, I worked up there at the Oktoberfest, sold a lot of beer, made a lot of money, got a nice bonus. Get a call, come back to in the chemical business. I go back in chemical business, and all of a sudden, my life gets really better. Able to pay school for the kids. Kids starting off to college now, and things accelerated, and all hell broke loose. My wife, 27 years, was working at Mercy University, and she'd been through all this trauma with me, the trauma of raising kids, and now she's going probably through an empty nest syndrome period of time. And she walks in one day and legitimately tells me that, I love you, but I can't live with you anymore. And I said, well, let's sit down and talk about it. She said, I've already talked about it. I told you years ago I was going to divorce you one day. Well, the day is here. I said, but baby, I've been sober 5 years. She said, I want to go to school full time, and it won't be fair for you. I mean, you need to do what you got to do. I need to do what I need to do. So we divorced. She went her way. I went mine. She married a real sick guy. I went to Atlanta and worked a couple of years and did my thing and went on up to Memphis, Tennessee, and I married a real sick girl. And all that came to pass, and God blessed both of us with more intelligence. We paid the price in spades for stupidity. She and I. Yes, we got married young, and yes, we had one of these lives, but let me tell you something about to love. God is love. You can bank it. Take it to the bank account. If you've ever had a real love in your life, it's there until you die. I don't give a toot what happens. They can divorce you. They can sue you. They can run you off. They can treat you ugly. Chemicals and mental illnesses are not just specific to alcoholism. It can happen at any time with anybody. What I learned in this program, through the grace of God in this program and the people that work with me, is that you have to take life on life's terms. With or without a wife, with or without a girlfriend, with or without a job, with or without children, with or without a college education, with or without having, been a hero in the war, anybody that has a desire can stop drinking in this program. That's what I learned over the long haul. Now, I can't tell you the number of people that have influenced my life since that time that have been an inspiration to me. My kids, my ex-wife at the time, my newfound love, which is the same lady. 18 years later, we're back together. Been together 6 years. Able to support her through her trauma. All of a sudden, it all comes together. God has a way of putting us in places that He wants us, whether we want to go or not. Now, you can fight it, or you can just join God and be part of His program. It's a God program. If I fight it, I'm just one sick boy that needs some help. But when I got in God's program, I've got honesty on my side. I've got decency on my side. I don't hit up on the young folks coming in the program. Sick, really sick people. I protect the program. I work with people. I help clean the building, bathroom, make the coffee. Teach folks I work with to do the same. And that's how this program has survived since 1935. If someone's got a better date, let me know what it is. But it's been a great ride. 32 years of sobriety, every day has not been a holiday. But I can tell you this, no day has ever been an all-day bad day.
Yeah.
And before I came in here, every damn day was bad. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And thank God I found AA. I would be a vegetable or in a grave somewhere. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Sam. I'm going to pass these baskets now. Seventh tradition states that there are no dues or fees for AA membership, but your generous contribution,
they go a long way to help us support AA Central and AA Zone and bring in good speakers and do all the pay for the coffee and all that stuff. So we appreciate you sharing with us. And I've asked Tinsley to hand out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic.
Tinsley.
And I'm okay with microphones. Kind of like them. Here at, I'm an alcoholic. Did I say that earlier? Okay. I'll say it twice. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life, if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, one day at a time, we offer a white chip if you want to join this fellowship. Anybody want a white chip? Anybody got 30 days? We have a silver chip. We have a red chip for 90 days. Anybody got 90 days? Yellow chip for 6 months.
Yeah.
All right. A green chip for 9 months. Any birthdays, 1 year or multiples? Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Big hand for the chips you hold.
Thank you, Tinsley. Do we have any AA-related announcements? Yes, Mark.
My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
I'm teaching the meeting. If anyone would like any
interest, come to me. Mark. Yes, sir, Frank.
I'm Frank. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, Frank.
And NAMA has a membership drive going on. You can look at the flyers around the building and find out what it's about. But we also have an upcoming Alateen meeting starting at NAMA. So if you know of anybody that might be able to take advantage of that, there's things coming on Thursday night at 8 o'clock. That's the general stuff.
Thursday night, 8 o'clock, Alateen program. Okay.
Got another announcement?
Yeah, yeah.
My name is Mark, an alcoholic.
I'm Mark.
The Atlanta Men's Workshop is coming up October 8th to 10th. You can download the registration online, and they do have scholarships for those men who couldn't afford the whole fee. If you want any more information, see me at the meeting. Rock Eagle.
Yeah, Rock Eagle. Highly recommend that. That's one of the most powerful workshops for men. And also, ladies, there is a, I don't know the details, but there is a ladies' workshop at Rock Eagle coming up soon.
Yes, at Rock Eagle.
And what do you know what weekend then?
There's a ladies' workshop coming up at Rock Eagle.
Yeah.
Eagle Rock or whatever.
Rock Eagle.
In the beginning part of October.
Okay.
We
got a little time. You can make your plans. But those are great. I can tell you from experience. Okay. Well, we went a little long, but it was worth it, at least for me. Thank you, Sam. Appreciate you sharing with us. It was a long time, right? It finally worked out. I'd like to remind anybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Let's have a moment for a silent meditation. Let's pray for those still suffering inside this room and outside this room, and for any children that have no say in the matter. Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. Thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back as the worst that you were.
Thank you for coming.
Hold on just a second.
Hey, what's up?
Thank you.